Hello, and welcome to this premiere edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brûlé. Every week, we're going to look and listen to the forces and faces shaping the food, drink, and travel sectors from all corners of the world, up and down the food chain. Today, we get things underway when we meet chef, author, and broadcaster Allegra McEvedy, who's just released her latest book.
And there's so much plastic rubbish out there in terms of cookbook. A Reflex, another barbecue book, another this book, and you know, it just becomes so... So I just wanted to do something that was absolutely splat out of the heart.
And we hear from Wally Olins reminiscing about what he would like and wouldn't like on the table for his last meal.
I really do not like tasting menus. I don't like little bits. I don't like pineapple dressed up as snails or snails dressed up as pineapple. I don't like any of that.
And we also have a taster of goat milk ice cream. More from Billy a little bit later. All that plus a few wine tips from Japan on this first episode of The Menu. Welcome to the launch of The Menu, Monocle's weekly entertaining program bringing you inspiring chefs, fresh food brands, clever interior designers, and must-visit culinary neighborhoods, plus a weekly audio version of My Last Meal from the pages of the magazine. First, we head to Chile and its meandering Pacific coastline. Our Santiago correspondent, Steve Bodzin, went to the city of Valparaiso to report on some of the more bizarre sea creatures that end up on the dinner table.
I'm at the Los Porteños restaurant in Valparaiso. Chile catches around 4 million tons of fish, crustaceans, and other seafood a year. If they didn't export any of it, everyone here could eat almost a kilogram of seafood every single day. I'm here to do my bit. What just arrived is a clay bowl full of broth. I stir it around and I can see all sorts of animals in there. There's some orange clams and a couple different kinds of mussels. Then there are these little pink arrow-shaped slabs of flesh. These are machas. Machas is usually translated as razor clam. They're pretty much only found in Chile. The meat is hard, but it's not tough. You bite into it, and it breaks apart. The puré is one of the odder items you'll find on the coast here. When you break one of these open, inside you find a brilliant red ball of flesh. That's the puré. They're high in iodine, so some people find the flavor unbearable. Personally, I like them. To find out more about where all this comes from, I go down to the market. I'm in a warehouse near the docks and talking to Luis Onoso. He's 79, and he's been selling fish and seafood here for how long?
60 años.
60 years. He's popping open one mussel after another, sucking them down raw with just a bit of lemon squeezed on top. He says he eats at least a kilo of raw mussels every single day. Yesterday, he also ate 3 more kilos with rice for dinner. I see something I've never seen before. These are tiny lobsters, like the size of my hand. One thing I'm not seeing is sea urchin. Urchins are basically balls of spikes. The fishmonger breaks them open and pulls out these 5 little tongues of meat, one from each section of the animal. The meat is pale golden. They literally look like tongues. I had always thought urchin was just a glob of salty goo. When I've had it here, fresh from the sea, it's a whole different creature. Onoso says Japanese buyers take the whole harvest, since they're willing to pay about $1 per urchin. That's more than double what the locals pay. Other items you should keep an eye out for if you ever get here are locos, which are kind of like clams, but they just have one side. So they slide around on the rocks. And here's the thing. Chile harvests over 150 species of living creature from the ocean. You got seaweed, fish, mollusks, crustaceans, you name it. In Valparaiso, last year, they commercialized 5 tons of sea snails. So you just keep your eyes open. Be willing to try whatever you come across. You never know. It might be delicious. In Valparaiso, Chile, this is Stephen Bodzin for Monocle 24.
Each week on The Menu, we're going to be getting recommendations from food and drink specialists from some of our favorite restaurants, bars, and cafes around the world. I caught up with Gaku Yokokawa at Maru in Tokyo last week, where he offered us his top drink tips for an enjoyable evening.
Today's sparkling wine is Yamagata-ken Takahata Winery Chardonnay sparkling wine. It's very 辛口なんですけど、若干やっぱ果実味とかもしっかり残ってて、とっても美味しいです。
You're back with the menu here on Monocle 24, and that was Gaku Yokokawa and his recommendation for a Japanese sparkling white wine from Takahata Yoshi. It's time for a bit of buying, a bit of borrowing, and a bit of stealing in the form of a new book by Allegra McEvity. The book is called Bought, Borrowed, and Stolen, and it thumped down on my desk. I just come back from Japan, and I wasn't sure if this was something which was sent by a PR, whether it was a gift. I was hoping it was a gift. Then I realized it was the assignment for this premiere program that we're doing. It's an absolutely stunning book.
Oh, Tyler, thank you so much.
It's great because you can tell. It's the photography. I don't know what your view. You must have had a few views, Allegra, because when you look at so many cookbooks today, yes, they're lovely. You know, the typesetting is beautiful and everything, but the photography is really stunning in this.
To be honest, this is my fifth cookbook, and I was really bored of looking through, you know, food mags and cookbooks, and just if I saw another soft focus napkin ring, I'm actually going to barf all over it.
Yeah, or just more crap digital photography where everything is washed out, nothing looks exciting or delectable, and that you want to dive into it, and it's not contrived, and it's a really beautiful journey. So let's rewind.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and the journey to five books, but also to really getting to Bought, Borrowed, and Stolen.
Oh my God, that's a massive question. How long have we got?
Alice, I told you, we've got 90 minutes yeah. for this show.
Well, I'll take up most of that with my life story. Started off in a very middle-class family and was supposed to be a barrister. Went to about 16 thinking I was going to be a barrister, then made massive screw-ups in my life. Found out I was gay, got kicked out of school. Decided not to... How am I doing? Is this a good pace?
Listen, more listeners are tuning in. It's fine. Keep going.
So there I was, having been to this one of the poshest schools in London and come out with really rubbish A-levels, and thought, actually, if I go into tertiary education, such as university, I will just get thrown out. So I mucked around for a few years and then decided cooking. What I like about cooking is it's quite proletariat. You get a whole mix of worlds in the kitchen. You know, you get people who are educated, people who've just arrived in the country and don't speak English. And that really appealed to me at the time. I liked the fact that I was a woman entering a man's world and, you know, I'd had something to prove. Mm. And I also love food. So that's how it started in terms of the cooking. Then I've done various things, went over to New York and worked for Robert De Niro, came back to London, opened my first restaurant in a community centre, again with that sense of good foods are right for everybody, not just something for the middle classes or the posh people. All of that's against the background of my historian father, which is why I travelled so much as a child, and that really got that bug. Then I started writing. Is that enough?
That's enough. I want to go back to the historian father and the travelling, because there is, and I say this in a really polite way, that there's a wonderful scrapbook feeling to this, and it really feels like a journey as you go through the book. But again, without being contrived and over art directed and just naff, as it could be in the hands of many others, perhaps.
It's very real. I mean, how this book came about is that when my dad used to take us on these holidays where we go and sort of climb over Roman ruins in Turkey and be sort of measuring cannonballs in France and, you know, from the 10th century and, you know, really crazy. I didn't even know what a beach holiday was until I went on my honeymoon. I literally had no concept of it. And he encouraged me and my sister to keep diaries. I mean, he thought we'd be writing about what we'd seen that day and so-and-so's mausoleum and the great baptisteries in Florence. And when he looked at my diary, it was just literally had the most amazing hot chestnuts. Oh, and, you know, then I saw some pasta here. And, you know, I was only 8 or 9, loved the gelati, whatever it was. And my diaries became about food. And then when I became a chef, they were literally just focused on food, market, anything I saw that caught my interest that I ate in a restaurant or saw in a shop window or anything to do with food. And I just jotted it down in the diary. I did this for 20 years and I looked at my diaries and I thought, because I'd only ever done it for myself as a resource for my recipes that I write for my restaurants or my columns or whatever. Mm. And I looked at it and I just thought, actually, that is so real. And there's so much plastic rubbish out there in terms of cookbooks, you know, a reflex, another barbecue book, another this book. And, you know, it just becomes so, that I just wanted to do something that was absolutely splat out of the heart.
The fact files that dot the book, was that also sort of just part of the diary in that sense? Because it's great that you go into, I mean, here we are, you know, in the Philippines, in one part of the book. And, you know, is that sort of part of, you know, your father dragging you around the world and you sort of having these little mini dossiers before you showed up at some ruin somewhere?
But you go, flash, I probably was. You know, you sit there and you sort of get these lectures from Pa about something. And we used to joke, you know, where was the off button? Because you got it whether you wanted it or not. But I put those fact files in, and there's one for every country, because I think it's really important to contextualise why people eat what they eat. So, for example, example, I give a religious breakdown. So you know what kind of people, you know, what they're going to be attracted to. You know, I put in there what foods they import and export. You know, what was the favorite, my favorite thing that I ate. So you get a kind of snapshot of what every culture is like before you launch yourself into the recipes.
Mm. The narrative as we go through, is there a particular sort of rhyme and reason? I mean, aside from that, that also, you know, it's punctuated by knives. As I might sort of point out also that the top of the world has various sharp instruments also protruding from it.
Well, yes, it does. In life, as on my book cover. no, I'm, well, the first part of this book is about the food diaries. The second part is about these knives, because every time I go away, I bring back a knife that to me represents a part of the soul of that country. Mm. So, you know, from Malawi, I brought back a tea tending knife because I spent my time there on fair trade tea plantations. And when I went up
to... How many times, I have to ask you, how many times have you actually made it through security with the old, oops, I thought it was in my check-in, but in fact, actually, I did make it through with this 9-inch blade.
Amazingly, it happens
quite... It does happen from time
really
to time,
does
doesn't
happen,
it?
Yeah, and then I have a very embarrassing thing where I say, well, look, I'm a chef, and, you know, so it's okay, and this is why I'm carrying them. And, you know, I've been in situations where I've said to them, look, give me an onion, and I'll show you I'm a chef. You know, I'll chop it down for you, because they don't like it.
Right. Okay, so it has happened, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. It's happened. I don't mean to scare people out there.
No, but it is a bit crap and lax out there, isn't it? For all the huff and puff that goes on.
It's amazing what gets through. I mean, you know, but you see the person who's supposed to be watching the monitor and they're looking at everywhere apart from the monitor as my sort of 3-foot-long Burmese machete slides in through.
Well, I was also interested because our producer, Marcus Hippie, he's Finnish, if you could tell by the last name. The Finns are
just very cool.
Yeah, the Finns are really into their knives. Have you noticed that? I mean, it's quite amazing when you go through just the center of Helsinki that here is this, you know, small country, 5 million-ish people. But the knife industry there is quite remarkable.
Well, absolutely. But I mean, lots of countries are like Germany's famous for its knives. And you said you've just come back from Japan. I mean, God, do they take their steel seriously? Have you been to that the amazing knife shop in Kyoto? It's been serving the emperors, the royal families, for I think 10 centuries.
Yeah, which is in the wonderful arcade. But it's incredible. I mean, we could spend a whole show just on knives. We could spend a whole series on Japan. Why don't we do that?
Yeah, a series on Japanese knives. I'm right there, Tyler.
Where did the fascination come from, though?
What, with the knives?
Yeah.
Well, because, I mean, it's so simple. What you need in life when you're cooking, you know, the tools of our trade are so simple. You know, you need to have a steel and a knife and some ingredients and a heat source. And, you know, in the way that everyone has got computers and this, that and the other, to be a chef, you just need a good knife. And you actually do only need probably 3 knives in your life. You need a serrated, a good chef's knife, and a little paring knife.
I like the Oaxacan whacker.
The Oaxacan whacker. Yeah, I know. I was particularly pleased when I came up with that name because it's quite complicated on the spelling.
Oaxaca is just for large chunks of meat, just to...
Yeah, it's a small cleaver. It's a small cleaver, so you use it for small pieces of meat with bones.
And you own one.
I own all of them.
Okay.
These are my knives. This is about a third of my knives. I've got about 60 or 70 and there's 20 in the book, and I've got about 60 or 70 at home. I love knives. Women collect shoes. Some women, I collect knives.
Tell me, just, I want to go back to the narrative of the book. You know, where did you whittle this down from? Because, I mean, it's exhaustive in a great way because, you mean, you could really go through several years of just cooking and cooking at home and there's fantastic things in it. But, you know, where did you start from? Where did you end up in terms of then sort of the definitive list, if that's what it is?
Well, it's part one of the definitive list. If this book flies, I've got another one absolutely ready to go. I went through all those food diaries. I've got about 20 volumes. They look incredibly beaten up. They look like traveler's diaries. And, you know, I've probably got about sort of, you know, lots of volumes of them. And I went through all of them from, you know, when I was a child through to my last holidays and just made a list of the best recipes. And it was 300 and something or other. And I was like, that's a big book, too big. So I whittled it down and cooked some. And some didn't work and some worked really well. Anyway, there's 123 in the book and those are my top 123.
How long did this journey take?
Well, 20 years via 5 years, basically.
So from commissioning... to actually get it, or...
No, because what I did is I had such a strong idea. As you can tell, this is a book from the heart, Tyler.
Yeah, no, you really do feel that this was not something, because I'm sure if, you know, perhaps in the hands of another publisher, they might have focus grouped it, and they might have said, you know, there's a little bit too much history, and the knives are going to scare people and whatnot.
Yeah, they did.
But, no, you can, you got your way, Allegra.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you, to answer your question, I spent a year preparing, whereas most people would just put in a sheet of A4 as their proposal, I put in a 20-page little book, because I knew how I wanted it to look. I knew what I wanted in terms of the scrapbook, the fact files, the big knife DPS double-page spread. You You know, I wanted all of that. I knew I wanted that. That was the book that I wanted to write. So when I went to them and said, look, this is it, they were like, oh, OK, then. All right, then. And then, you know, went to a little bidding war and eventually someone won. And then I started writing. But it was quite a long time up till then.
And the design?
A wonderful, talented lady called Natasha Coverdale, who, again, we worked on that little book together, which sold the big book. And she just got it. She's, you know, it's a heart book, this. And she's a lady full of heart.
Allegra McEvity, thank you very much. You're listening to Monocle 24. We're back in a moment. But before that, here is Gaku-san's tip for a Japanese white.
今日飲んだ日本の白ワインは、山梨県の、四温醸造っていうところで、すごい生産量が少ないところなんですが、その窓辺っていうシリーズの甲州で、すごい、フルーティーですごく美味しいです。
Like any unforgettable experience, the best gatherings aren't engineered. They're created with skill and a spark, and an eye on just the right blend of taste, excellence, and passion. Join the community of Krug lovers at Krug.com, and always put happiness at the top of your to-do list. Krug, crafting happiness since 1843.
Keep abreast of everything from breaking news to fresh business opportunities with Monocle 24's lineup of live weekday current affairs programs. The Globalist kicks off our day at 6 a.m. UK time with 2 hours of news, media reviews, weather and reports from our correspondents around the world. At midday UK time, The Briefing helps the North American East Coast get into gear with a brisk review of news and analysis. And at 18:30 UK, Midori House gets a first read on stories hitting Asia's front pages and does a roundup with Monocle's editors. Finally, the Monocle Daily signs on for 2 hours at 2200 with a mix of our editors and special guest anchors to start the day in Asia. Keep an eye and an ear on the world, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to The Menu here on Monocle 24, where the wine tip before the break was for a lovely bottle of white from Shonjozu Madabe Koshu. Now, it's time for the debut of our audio version of My Last Meal from the back pages of Monocle. Now, our first guest needs little introduction for anyone with even a passing interest in design, branding, and creating better experiences for consumers. Wally Oldens is the chairman of Safran Brand Consultants and is famous for his work on brands including Repsol, Q8, and Tata. He's recently even taken a liking to Poland, and he tells our Steve Bloomfield who he'd invite to his last meal and what would be on his plate. They sat down at Le Café Anglais in London.
Wally, what do you think?
I'd like half a dozen oysters.
Yes.
The Malden Rock, like? Malden Rock to be fine.
Malden Rock, yeah. For you, sir?
And then I'd like grouse, please, the roast grouse.
The grouse. Would you like it medium, sir?
I like it rare.
Because the chef is making it medium, actually.
The chef what?
He's preparing it medium. I can ask rare.
Well, look, if he prepares it medium, this place is good. If he prepares it medium, it'll be fine.
Yes, he always told me medium rare.
It's pretty pink in the middle, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, well, that's what I like.
Medium.
I mean, yeah.
Perfect.
Medium to medium rare.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Please, gentlemen.
Can I have the raw tuna?
The tuna, sir.
And I'll also have the grouse.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about food. What are your memories of food when you were growing up, when you were at home with your family?
Ghastly.
Really?
School food was ghastly. Home food was ghastly. It was all awful.
In what way?
In every way you can think of. I mean, first of all, it was just after the war, so there wasn't much food around. Secondly, my mother hadn't the faintest idea how to cook. I mean, not the remotest clue. And school food was just as bad. I mean, I never knew what food was. I thought the nicest thing you could eat was beans on toast. I thought that was great, beans on toast.
And is that what your mother made, or was that what...
No, she didn't make beans on toast. She used to sort of take a chicken and sort of kill it, roast it to death. I mean, I don't know what... I mean, it was just terrible. And I think the first... At university, the food was terrible too.
When was the first time that you remember really enjoying a meal and realizing what great food was?
I think when I went into the army for a bit, I thought the food was better there than anywhere else. No, but I mean, I think that in the 50s, which is what I'm talking about, there were just a few places where you could eat extraordinary things. And I remember eating, when I was about 24, jugged hare. I hadn't a clue what jugged hare was.
Jugged hare.
Hair.
Hair as in like hair a rabbit hair. H-A-R-E.
H-A-R-E. And it was called jugged hare. And it's a particular... I still like game. I'm very, very fond of game. And I remember I'd never eaten anything like it. It had an enormous, I mean, impact on me. And I thought it was just wonderful. I didn't realize food could be so wonderful. Another time I remember when I was very young, I think probably the best meal I've ever had in my life, in my memory. I went hitchhiking with a friend in France. And we stood there doing that. You did that then, you know. And we had, nobody stopped, of course, because they do after an hour and a half. And we had a fresh baguette and cheese. I don't know, it was probably something like camembert and fresh peaches. And I had never, ever eaten anything so wonderful at that time. And I still remember, and I still really enjoy fresh baguette and cheese and peaches and that sort of thing, and figs. I love that kind of thing now. And that gives me huge pleasure. It's just fun, it's just nice. I don't like complicated food very much. I like very simple food. And one of the reasons I like this place is because it's brasserie-like, it's very simple. The thing I can't bear is 19 courses with sorbets in the middle and all that stuff they do. I mean, they do all that stuff. Tasting menus.
You're not a fan of tasting menus.
I really don't like them. I really do not like tasting menus. I don't like little bits. I don't like pineapple dressed up as snails, or snails dressed up as pineapple. I don't like any of that. I like this stuff. I like what they do here. Oysters, grouse, meat. I like, as I get older, God knows I'm old enough, but as I get older, I like more and more vegetarian things. I'm not remotely involved in it emotionally, but I just like things like quiche and tart and all that sort of stuff, pie.
You lived in India for a few years.
Yeah, 5 years, yeah.
What were your food experiences like there? Was it quite different from what you'd experienced beforehand?
Oh, yeah. I mean, an Indian restaurant in England in the 1950s or 60s, I mean, it was just slops, you know, it wasn't anything. There was a restaurant in Oxford called the Taj Mahal. You went there because it was so cheap. I mean, they'd pile your plate up with brown muck for, I don't know, 1 9 pence or something. I mean, yeah. Didn't taste of it. Well, it tasted hot, that's all. No, I loved the food in India. The food in India was great. But, you know, when I went to India, I was married, just got married. And then we had 2 children in India. And we had a cook. We had a driver. We had a bearer, that is to say, a personal butler. We had a hamal. That's to say, the guy who assisted the bearer. And we had something else. Oh, yes, a nanny when the children were
born. So even the butler had his own assistant?
And the point was, we had a cook, as I said. And the cook was Goanese, as a lot of cooks were. And they always cooked English food. And they didn't cook it very well. And when they cooked Indian food, it was marvellous. So we had to try and persuade the cook to cook Indian food rather than English food. The Indian food was great. The English food is indifferent. Yeah, but I like food in India a lot, and I still do. I like Indian food. But I mean, there's no such thing as Indian food, you know, really, because there are so many different kinds of Indian food. Bengali food is very fish focused, and Punjabi food is sort of tandoor and all that kind of thing. And what you get here mostly in England is Bangladesh, people from Bangladesh who are sort of imitating Punjabi food, and it doesn't come out very well. But there's wonderful food in it. Well, there's wonderful food everywhere. I mean, there's only one cuisine, as they call it, that I'm not wild about, and that's Mexican. I really can't do with double fried beans or whatever they are. I mean, I don't like, but everything else, almost everything, I really do. Really love food.
And is that one of the things that you like about traveling? Because you travel an awful lot still now.
I like meeting people. I'm very, you know, if you want to be polite, you say I'm very curious. If you want to be rude, you say I'm very nosy. I just like to know what's going on. Yes, the food is really important. Japanese food is marvelous. Absolutely. The whole ritual of Japanese food. Now, there's something where they do take a long time, and they do it in a very complex way, but it is so beautiful. And the way it is served is so beautiful. I went, a few weeks ago, I went to a Chinese restaurant in Tokyo, hosted by a Japanese friend of mine, and it wasn't like Chinese food. I mean, it was Chinese food, but the way they did it, the style was Japanese, so it kind of tasted different. Well, it was all sort of, you know, the way they served the rice and the way they served this and the way that... I love that. I love the style of Japanese food, and I love... Well, I like Japan a lot, and I really like Japanese food, and I like the way they do it, even though I don't like nine courses and tasting menus in England, or in the West, but in Japan it's somehow different. But I know, it doesn't excite me, but I know if I'm going to Japan the food will be good. So if you're going to Dubai, then maybe less so. Dubai, you know, it depends where you are, because the food can be anything, can be absolutely anything. If you go to Germany, Austria particularly, the food can be marvellous, but you've got to be very selective. If you select it carefully, you can eat terrifically well in Austria or Germany. But if you're not selective, you can end up with something really rather boring. Italy, I find the food is very nice, but I do get sick of pasta and pizza. I mean, you know, a few days of it, you can't have a diet of it forever. I like Spanish food a lot. There's hardly any food I don't like, actually. I'm not wild about, as I said, I'm not wild about Mexican food. I used to go to Mexico a lot. I taught there for a time.
Yeah.
You know, for three weeks, whatever it was.
But your distaste of their food didn't have any effect on whether you
carried on going? Look, I like most people and I like most places, unless something happens which is nasty. But usually you find you know, people are kind of warmish and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Very good oysters.
Are they good? What's the sauce with them?
This is... sort of bits of Tabasco and all that stuff.
Okay. So let's turn to what your last meal would be. Today you've had the oysters and you're going to have the grouse.
Beans on toast, maybe?
Would you'd have that as part of your last meal?
Not really. What would I have as my last meal?
Well, who would you have? And what sort of occasion would it be?
Family. Very, very, very family oriented. Very family. If the duck... No. Goose. If the skin is really crispy, really crispy, and the flesh is quite well cooked, and so you've got rid of the fat, and there's really not much left of it, because that would be really nice. I like that. Goose would be really nice. But you can only have goose once or twice a year.
It's a special occasion.
I'd go for goose. Then I don't know about a first course. You can have a really nice salad as a first course. Something like oranges, avocado, some rocket or something like that, and maybe a bit of lime. So it's all kind of, you know, it's half a fruit salad and half a salad. And you put oil and vinegar on it and all that, but it's unusual. That would be nice because it's light. Then you'd maybe have the goose, or maybe a roast, maybe a really, really good roast. Beef or lamb, you know, really nice. Very conventional, I'm afraid. Sorry about all that.
That's quite right.
And then
it's your meal.
My meal. And then pudding. Well, the cheese. Lots of nice cheeses. But you have to have a long pause, because you're so full from the goose or the roast. Also, you could have fish. Fish would be very nice. You could start with crab. I'm getting into it now. You could start with crab. That would be nice. Start with crab a bit. And then maybe that. You can't have goose after the crab. I think you'd have to have...
I think you're veering into two different meals here, really, aren't you?
I am. I'm getting into two different meals. And I've only got one. I've only got one last supper.
Well, there's clearly a penultimate one here, then, and then the last one.
If I could have an anti-penultimate one, I'd have a Japanese one, I think. That'd be nice.
Really? And what would you have in your Japanese one?
Oh, I don't know what. I mean, they just give you all these marvellous things. I've got no idea what they are. I mean, everything's sushi and both of this and that. I've got no idea what they are. Little bits of tiny, slightly fried thing, raw. The great thing about Japanese meals is if you're in a restaurant, anywhere, and you're sitting at the bar, there's a theatre. We go to a friend of mine, a Japanese friend of mine, and I go to, it's just a crummy little chicken place. Nothing. You sit at the bar, and the guy's cooking chicken. That's all they do. But he sees the bits of chicken you like. You like it slightly burnt, and you like the leg. So he can't speak English, and I can't speak Japanese. So there's a theatre between us. It gives you another one. And before you finish the first one, you find there's another one. And it's just... it's a theatre, and the way they clean everything, everything's cleaned the whole time. The tables, love it. It's marvellous. So that would be my entrepreneurial meal.
Wally Erlins, thank you very much. You're with The Menu. We're back in a moment.
What are the countries or the companies or the projects that you would love to take on?
Well, I've talked about the EU. I think we're very close to Poland, and we've worked a lot with Poland. And I think Poland's a marvellous opportunity. And I think that it looks as though everything's going to work out quite well. I hope it will.
They also have the advantage that with Euro 2012 they compare rather favourably to Ukraine.
You can say that again. So I think that Poland is a great opportunity because it's a country that is much misunderstood. It's much underrated. It has 40 million people. It's one of the major countries in Europe. So that's a huge opportunity. Huge opportunity.
But it's also a country that, you know, if you ask most people what they think of, they might remember that, you know, the President and the Prime Minister were twins. They might remember that they, you know, rather brutally broke up gay pride marches. That's probably about it.
Well, I think you're right. They might remember solidarity. They might remember the Pope.
Yes, yeah, okay. I'm being a bit unfair, but
what
still.
What you're saying is true. What you're saying is the perceptions of Poland are far, far, far worse than the reality. Great, marvellous opportunity for us. I would like to work there, and I think we've had a lot to do with them and it's moving very well. I think another country in Eastern Europe that I have a great weakness for is Romania. And if you want a problem, boy, have they got a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes Poland look like France. Everything associated with Romania is kind of gungy. And actually, a lot of it's great.
Yeah.
Great people, funny, terrific sense of humour, very self-mocking, but deeply lacking in self-confidence, understandable, and terrific potential. And 20 million people, not nothing.
No. And so that's business. What about personal? Are there regrets? Are there things you wish you'd done differently? If you were to look back now?
Probably. But I don't want to talk about them.
That's all right. But again, always heart over head.
Probably. Almost certainly. Yeah, there are always things you regret, sure. Or you think you would have done it, regret. What's regret? There are always things you feel... not for me, thank you. There are always things you feel you could have done differently. But... I mean, if I look back on my so-called career, it's all accident. You know, I didn't plan anything, it just happened. And I'm very spontaneous and very intuitive. And if you're like that, you get things wrong and you get things right. So, yeah, I guess I've made quite a few mistakes. Lots. I didn't choose anything. Things chose me, really.
Okay, so you wouldn't define your career as successful?
Yeah, I'm moderately successful, I think, I'd say. Moderately.
Well, that's as good a place as any to leave it.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That's wonderful.
That was Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, talking to Wally Olins. We're back in a moment, but first, here's Gakko with a red wine suggestion.
最後に飲んだ赤ワインは、山梨県の、また同じあの四温醸造の今度はブドウの品種がベリエっていう品種でとてもすごいあの果実味が強くてすごい軽いんですけど深い複雑な味わいがあります。
Like any unforgettable experience, the best gatherings aren't engineered.They're created with skill and a spark, and an eye on just the right blend of taste, excellence, and passion. Join the community of Krug lovers at Krug.com, and always put happiness at the top of your to-do list. Krug, crafting happiness since 1843.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Menu. Now, before the break, the sommelier at Maru in Tokyo suggested Shunyozu Ruzo Aka to go with a nice bit of beef from Yamagata. Now, if you've ever wondered what an F1 racer's diet is like and whether they even have to concern themselves with the regime, our correspondent Ted Kravitz has the answers.
Between the cigarette sponsors and oil company logos, Playboy world champion James Hunt used to wear a badge of his own on his race suit. It said, Sex, Breakfast of Champions. These days, though, Breakfast of Champions is more likely to consist of porridge, skim milk, and a protein shake. That's because although motor racing just looks like a load of guys sitting down and driving, inside the car, it's tough work. High cornering speeds mean high G-force. A driver's neck needs to be able to support up to 24 kilos, the weight of a fully laden suitcase, and they need formidable upper body strength. So the modern racing driver is a high-performance athlete, and his diet has been refined since Hunt's era of the 1970s. Ayrton Senna was the first driver to take fitness seriously in the late 80s, and it's now the stuff of science, with expert nutritionists designing menus to ensure peak energy delivery just after lunchtime on a Sunday afternoon. As this is the time the rest of the world chooses for a nice nap, one can see the nutritionists have their work cut out. The driver starts the day with slow-release carbohydrates. Tea and coffee are strictly forbidden as they dehydrate the body. Even a latte will send the nutritionists reeling. Lunch is taken early, so it has time to settle before an afternoon race. It's low fat, low salt, and low taste. Spaghetti with chicken, salad niçoise, no dressing, or rice and vegetables. That's because the driver doesn't want anything with flavour, because under braking, drivers are naturally burped by their seatbelts. Curry is strictly off the lunch menu. Plenty of water is taken to ward off dehydration, and then dinner is all about protein for recovery and muscle repair, and some more carbs for energy storage. That's fillet steak and baked potato, or sea bass and some more pasta. Here's an F1 diet you can try for yourself. It's the favourite lunch of Kimi Räikkönen, Finland's 2007 world champion. Boil up a cup of basmati and wild rice, empty a can of yellowfin tuna on top, or teas if you have it, before chopping up a whole red onion and sprinkling on top. Lace it with white wine vinegar to sweeten the onion, and serve. But it's not only Räikkönen who has an interest in food. Lotus driver Jarno Trulli owns and runs the Podere Castorani, a small vineyard in the hills west of Pescara. And if you've ever bought anything from the organic, biodynamic Laverstoke Park farm, that's 1979 world champion Jody Scheckter's. Sweet treats are few and far between, although ice cream is a weakness for many drivers. Michael Schumacher used to have a Carpegiani gelato machine secretly hidden away in the back of the Ferrari motorhome. Others believe that carrots do indeed help you see in the dark and chomp them down to help them see the corners better at high speed. And finally, there's the spoils of victory, magnums of mum champagne if you finish first, second or third. But as the drivers are athletes, any more than a sip tends to render them tipsy, so they prefer to spray it all over their teammates. The organisers of the Indianapolis 500 thought that was a waste, so after Louis Mayer started the tradition of drinking buttermilk after that race in 1933, today's winners of the Indy 500 also receive a pint of milk. They can choose whole, semi-skimmed or skimmed. Most choose skimmed. And that is life in the fast lane.
That was Ted Kravitz. And if things weren't speedy enough already, here's a little jolt of caffeine from Stockholm's Café Verket in our weekly barista check-in.
The last 5 years, I've only been indulging the coffee that's from the what we call the specialty coffee scene. So, you know, if I don't make coffee for myself, I try to go to the places that actually delivers that and that actually kind of works with that. Also and foremost, maybe understands what that is. When you look at the way you do it or what kind of beans you choose, it's absolutely a very big knowledge and also understanding and also a curiosity about the coffee, and that almost every time goes hand in hand with the view, the how you look at service, how you look at hospitality, how you look at your own business, and how you look at the scene where people meet and how you communicate in those kind of places. Basically what we use when you're a barista, when you own a coffee house, you create a scene for people where they meet and where they develop whatever they want to develop. And what we use is we use the flavors in the cup, we use the lighting, we use the music, how that makes people feel and how they react to that. But the coffee is basically the essence of it.
That was Johan Algren from Café Verket in Stockholm. We're cutting away for a short break with a sake chaser.
今日のお酒は, 香川の, コンピラさんの
That was Gakko Yokokawa from Maro with his sake tip, Yorokubo Gaijin Ebina Kamino. Up next, it's our food and drink find of the week in the shape of Santiago's basket. Welcome back to The Menu here on Monocle 24. We have a bit of a new segment. Well, it's a new program, and we have our editor, Santiago Tarditis, here with Santiago's Basket. What's going to happen in or on Santiago's Basket every week?
Well, I hope I don't have to skip through the forest with a basket under my arm.
Well, it might be somewhere else, but anyway.
Well, I think the idea is basically going to be that we're going to scour the world for new culinary trends and find out about new brands and interview interesting people that are doing incredible food products around the world.
And you've got some nice goodies in front of us here. Three little tubs from the Greedy Goat. And also one of the gentlemen behind it is Craig Allen. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I mean, first tub with me and Santiago. Great packaging. We've got a goat with a spoon in his mouth on this sort of lovely mossy sort of minty green background, and it says ice cream made from British goat's milk. And in the interest of full disclosure, I can't stand goat's cheese, and I see spoons and I see bowls in front of me, so am I going to like this?
I hope so, and it's not from goat's cheese, it's from goat's milk. So.
Right, no, I know, but...
Is the flavor similar?
To goat's cheese?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
No. So neither of you have tried this yet.
Never.
Okay, while I start unpacking here, just tell us a little bit about the idea, because, you know, did you spot a niche for something which was just perhaps, you know, a little bit, more interesting? There was a hook having goats. What was it? Because actually, I like goats themselves very much. I like the square pupils and that they climb and all of those things. But where did the idea start?
Well, essentially, at a dinner party over glass of wine, as most good ideas tend to sort of originate. We were discussing the ice cream from UK supermarkets and delis, and one of the things we were discussing was that it wasn't the most expiring, you couldn't get the most expiring, inspiring flavours. It wasn't necessarily always that healthy, and we thought it would be great to come up with a healthier ice cream with some really interesting flavours, which I think you might be trying at the moment.
Do we know what this one is?
I'm having the green one. What is the green one?
That's pistachio.
Okay.
Very good. So what's special about this ice cream? How is it different from the rest of ice cream?
Well, goat's milk ice cream is essentially, it's low in fat, low in calories. It's approximately...
Of course you'd say that, Craig. Come on.
No, it is. And it's also easy to digest for people that have lactose intolerances, which is something like 1 in 5 people across Northern Europe.
Right.
There's so many people that can't eat dairy products because they have a reaction to the sugar in the lactose. obviously that gives us quite a big market. We also don't just want to focus on the health aspects, but that obviously makes it a lot more attractive because people obviously are more health conscious, and with the food market changing so much in the UK over the last 5 years, we wanted to sort of follow that as well and also come up with some really interesting flavours. For instance, there's one of our more risky flavours there is lemon, lime and sweet basil.
Which one is that? Which one? Is, I want to try that now.
That one there.
This one.
Yeah.
Just from a global perspective, is this unique from what you can gather, or someone also doing this in Switzerland or New Zealand? Is there a lot of goat's milk ice cream competition?
There's a couple of companies that make goat's milk ice cream, but it's again very sort of straightforward flavors. It's vanilla and strawberry, but nothing really exciting. And we've sort of, this year was our first year. We really wanted to sort of see what the response was to the ice cream, which has been amazing. We've had reviews in Tokyo and New York, and we have sort of lots of followers on Twitter and Facebook and stuff, and they want us to export this. So it's been amazing, and yeah, we're really, really pleased.
Can you actually go global with this? Because it's a product which comes from the UK. Does that mean you have to then find Japanese goats or then New Zealand goats? And it's really then about taking your brand global, but of course you're going to source the milk elsewhere.
Yes, I mean, that's what we're sort of looking at the moment. Next year, we're hoping to be in lots of delis. We've already had a couple of delis across London that have agreed to sell our products. Hopefully next year in 2013, we'll think about your sort of New York and Tokyo and stuff. So,
Santiago, over to your basket. Verdict?
I loved the lemon and basil one.
Good.
Very, very good.
I like this one. This was sort of the crunchy one over here.
I think that was maple and praline.
Yeah, no, I have to say it has nothing to do with goat's cheese.
No, not at all.
Does
it taste lighter on the?
It tastes like it does. Yeah, but also it just doesn't have that. There's almost sort of a predictable taste to so many ice creams, and there is a nice hint of something. But the good thing, it has nothing to do with Chev, which is a great relief to me. Craig Allen from The Greedy Goat, thanks very much. Best of luck.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Santiago, we'll see you next week with your basket again.
See you then.
You're listening to The Menu right here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippi, and our sound engineer was the appropriately named Anna Veal here at Midori House in London. And you can find out more about who and what's shaping the state of food retail in the November issue of Monocle, which is on sale now. We're back next week, but for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, goodbye.
Keep abreast of everything from breaking news to fresh business opportunities with Monocle 24's lineup of live weekday current affairs programmes. The Globalist kicks off our day at 6 a.m. UK time with 2 hours of news, media reviews, weather and reports from our correspondents around the world. At midday UK time, The Briefing helps the North American East Coast get into gear with a brisk review of news and analysis. And at 18:30 UK time, Midori House gets a first read on stories hitting Asia's front pages and does a roundup with Monocle's editors. Finally, the Monocle Daily signs on for 2 hours at 2200 with a mix of our editors and special guest anchors to start the day in Asia. Keep an eye and an ear on the world, right here on Monocle 24. We'll be right back.
You must speak you look around. I'm gonna suck in you. You must speak you look around. I'm gonna suck in you. Thank you.